From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, Karl Rove, the president's top political advisor, testified for more than 2 hours before a federal grand jury on who leaked Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA operative to the press. Plame's husband, former U.S. diplomat Joseph Wilson, says Rove arranged the outing as payback for Wilson's public debunking of pre-war Bush claims about Saddam Hussein's nuclear program. Journalists, too, are in the hot seat. On Wednesday, a federal district judge held Matthew Cooper of Time magazine in contempt of court for refusing to reveal his confidential sources on the Plame story. Last week, Judith Miller of the New York Times got the same news. They both face up to 18 months in jail. At least three more reporters, including NBC's Tim Russert and The Washington Post's Walter Pincus, have been subpoenaed to testify. The government says it's got a serious federal crime to solve. Journalists say exposing confidential sources destroys their ability to get at what's going on inside the government. Tonight on Point, Judith Miller makes her case, and we'll hear perspectives from both sides of the First Amendment law debate on journalists facing jail time for keeping confidences. We begin in New York with an update on the Valerie Plame CIA outing case and the journalists who have been called to testify. Tom Skoka is press columnist for the New York Observer. I asked him how it came to journalists getting jail sentences.
Well, it started back in July of 2003 when Joseph Wilson wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying that the Bush administration had exaggerated intelligence about uranium sales in Africa. About a week after that, Robert Novak of the Chicago Sun-Times wrote a column in which he said that Wilson had failed to disclose that his wife, a CIA agent, had sent him to Africa, basically.
And, of course, this was not public information that
this
his wife, Valerie Plame, was a CIA operative.
Right. And so the identity of a CIA operative had been leaked. And so an investigation set out to find who was responsible for leaking that information.
Because this is definitely or potentially a breach of federal law.
It's potentially a breach of federal law. It's a sort of a tricky law that governs whether people are allowed to disclose and publish the names of CIA agents or not, because it was originally a law written to stop a specific publication from outing CIA agents.
It seems presumed that it was someone likely fairly high in the Bush administration who leaked this. So why is it journalists instead of administration officials that are being brought in here, or is everyone being brought in?
Because it's a grand jury proceeding, there's not a lot of knowledge about exactly who's been brought in. Karl Rove was brought in today, actually, to talk to the grand jury. Other administration officials have interviewed with investigators without necessarily testifying before the grand jury. And the real wild card in all this is Bob Novak, who's the guy who actually printed the leak, who has not told anyone whether he has been brought before the grand jury, whether he has testified, whether he's pleaded the Fifth Amendment. There's just no knowledge at all about what Novak has or hasn't done.
What other journalists have been brought into this?
There have been a handful of others. I think Tim Russert went in before. The two who've been held in contempt are rather different cases from Novak and from each other. The one who most recently got held in contempt was sent to jail on Wednesday and stayed pending appeal was Matthew Cooper of Time magazine.
Mm-hmm.
What he did was after the Novak column came out, he wrote a piece for Time magazine about how administration officials, unnamed, had been trying to leak this information. I think he actually said a single administration official in his piece. Other people have cited leaks from possibly two administration officials.
And so it would appear from his reporting that someone had leaked this to him.
That would be
apparently
the presumption.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then Judith Miller of the New York Times had not written anything. She had purportedly fielded this leak, thought about writing something. It's not clear even how far it got in the New York Times' editorial process, but they decided not to write anything about it. But still, she was subpoenaed to discuss what she may or may not have gotten from a confidential source.
And we'll hear from Judith Miller in a moment and from the chairman and publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Sulzberger. But at this point, Judith Miller is also facing an 18-month prison sentence that's been stayed pending appeal.
It's a coercive confinement rather than an actual criminal conviction or punishment. So the idea is that they are supposed to be held as long as the grand jury is sitting or 18 months, whichever is shorter, unless they change their mind and talk to the grand jury.
Tom, how unusual is it for reporters to be put in this situation of facing prison time for not giving away a confidential source, someone to whom they have presumably promised secrecy?
It's highly unusual. The last person to go to jail under these circumstances was a New York Times reporter in 1978, and he went for 40 days during the course of a murder trial. This open-ended, you know, 18-month thing where nobody even knows how long the grand jury is convened for is extremely unusual.
President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of State Colin Powell, other senior administration officials have had to talk with investigators in this case. Another widespread presumption is that if President Bush wanted to, he could just send the word down saying, I want to know who leaked this, and I want their hand to go up right now, and we'll just solve and settle this. Why not that path instead, Tom?
That's a very good question, and it actually relates to the law involved here, because the investigators are supposed to put the screws to reporters in a situation like this only as a measure of last resort. When the courts ruled that reporters did have to answer to grand juries, what was underlying it was a notion that these reporters would have information that could not be gotten any other way. Given that this leak came from somewhere in the administration, it seems as if there are a whole lot of people besides reporters who should be able to shed light on it for the grand jury.
Is there a sense that there's intimidation going on here or avoidance by the administration of going more directly to a solution?
The argument that there's intimidation involved has been made. There's also just the simple fact that this is dragging out the investigation. And at this point, with Cooper and Miller both appealing the ruling, there won't be any disposition in their cases until after the election. One would guess by extension that there's not going to be any indictment handed down in this leak until after the election.
Politically convenient in itself. Tom Skoka, thanks so much for filling us in tonight. Thanks for being with us.
No, you're quite welcome.
Tom Skoka is press columnist for the New York Observer. He spoke with me from New York. We're talking tonight about the Valerie Plame CIA outing case and journalists being pushed under threat of very real jail time to reveal confidential sources. I spoke earlier to Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., chairman and publisher of the New York Times, and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Judith Miller, who has been reporting on national security for the Times and is now being held in contempt of court for refusing to reveal her sources. On October 7th, Judith Miller was sentenced to up to 18 months in jail by federal district judge Thomas Hogan. She is free, pending appeal. Judith Miller, welcome to One Point. It's good to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Arthur Sulzberger, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Judith Miller, we've spoken before over the last couple of years about circumstances all around the world. Now you are in the news. How does it feel to have a contempt citation against yourself and a jail sentence hanging over you?
Well, all things considered, I'd rather be covering the news than being it. Obviously, it's worrisome. It's worrying to my family. It's disappointing to me that the special prosecutor has gone down this path, and I think it should be of concern to all journalists and all readers of newspapers. It's obviously upsetting.
And are you prepared to spend that 18 months in jail if it comes to that?
If it comes to that, I don't really feel that I have a choice, because I really owe it to my readers and I owe it to the profession. And I just owe it to my conscience to protect the people whom I gave pledges of confidentiality to, not to yield to this kind of pressure. I don't really feel that I have much of a choice ethically here.
And Arthur Sulzberger, there you are, chairman and publisher of the New York Times. Your reporter is in the firing line here. How do you see the stakes in this issue, not only in Judith's case, but of course a number of journalists are on the line here? What is at stake in your view?
Well, first and foremost, we do worry about Judy. She's been an important part of the New York Times newspaper for a long, long time, and we can't lose that human factor. But you're right. The stakes here are about the free flow of information and about the ability of the public to make the decisions we need to keep a democracy alive. Whether we like it or not, the way Washington works and the way much of the world works is based on people who say, I'm going to talk to the press, but I'm going to do so on a confidential basis. And maybe they're people whose conscience has gotten to them and they feel they have to let the world know something, but they're risking their jobs or their families. And we have to take that seriously, because if we don't, we're going to be left reporting, and Judy can talk about this more eloquently than I, we're going to be left reporting press releases and covering speeches. And when we go into the voting booths, that's all we'll know. That's not good enough for this country.
You're saying without that promise of confidentiality and the faith that it will be kept, people just inside the government won't talk.
All of us as journalists want people to be on the record. We fight very hard for that because that helps our readers get some sense of the source of the material and perhaps the reason for that material being made public. But there are times, and especially in critical areas of intelligence or national security, where that's not going to happen, and we know that. But the information is still valid. The information is still true. The information is still important. I can give you no better example than the Washington Post Watergate, perhaps, to buttress this thought. That information is critical, and we are a conduit. We filter it, of course, in the sense that we don't put everything out. Let me remind you that Judy Miller never wrote a story based on the information she was given, and the New York Times never published a story based on that information. If Judy goes to jail, she will be going to jail for something she didn't do. We are fighting for the principle, and we think it's critical, and we think America should think it's critical.
Judy Miller, why do you think the special prosecutor is coming after you if, as your chairman and publisher says, you didn't publish this information about Valerie Plame?
Well, I think that that's part of our conundrum here as an institution. Our lawyers are in a very difficult position because we don't know whether or not the special prosecutor has really exhausted the other avenues of inquiry that he's obligated under the law to pursue before he comes to journalists. I mean, he subpoenaed 5 different journalists already, and we don't know what else he's done. So it's very hard for our attorneys and my attorney to figure out whether or not the prosecution has really done its job in terms of meeting the statutory obligations of that law. And, you know, this growing secrecy should worry all of us. You were talking before about how important it is in national security and intelligence cases, information involving those sensitive subjects, for people to be able to come forth and feel that they can talk to a journalist and know their identity will be protected. Well, you know, in a post-9/11 environment, so much more is classified secret today than it was 3 years ago before 9/11. And reporters are increasingly finding whole categories of information that used to be public is now confidential, secret. It's just harder and harder to do your job.
Let me ask you, though, Judy, is this one awkward? Because, of course, what is at issue here is the exposure of Valerie Plame as a CIA agent, and that exposure is a federal crime. So whoever was speaking...
The exposure may be a federal crime. That's one of the issues the special prosecutor is looking at. Motive is important, whether or not this was part of a pattern of activities. All of those factors go into a determination about whether or not a crime has even been committed here. So, you know, we find ourselves, the Times and I, in an ironic situation of I may be forced to serve time in jail for something that winds up not to be a crime.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, this was not by any standard, as far as I can make out, the story of a heroic whistleblower unveiling some kind of wrongdoing inside the government. On the contrary, these comments were meant to do harm, apparently.
One person's whistleblower is another person's potential criminal. Let me twist this thought just a little bit and imagine how people felt on one side of the equation when the Pentagon Papers were released. Those were released by someone in a very confidential way to the New York Times, and they gave the story of the Vietnam War. They were critically important to the Americans' understanding of that war, and yet a lot of Americans felt that the person who did that had engaged in a criminal act.
But that still falls, yeah, doesn't it, at least in the eye of history, in the whistleblower category.
But you see, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
You don't know at the moment. You don't know. This information, which, as Judy rightly points out, may or may not have been an illegal act, that's yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. But let's assume for a moment that it was. We don't know yet how history will view that. We do know, however, that the immediate effect of Judy or Matt giving up their sources on this story will have an immediate detrimental effect to Americans getting the information they need.
We'll hear more from New York Times chairman and publisher Arthur Sulzberger Jr. and Times reporter Judith Miller after the break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Valerie Plame CIA outing case and reporters under the gun to reveal confidential sources. In a few minutes, you can join this conversation should the federal government be sentencing journalists to prison time for protecting their sources. Someone outed CIA operative Valerie Plame. Some journalists know who. Should they be forced to tell, even if they promised confidentiality? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's return to my conversation with Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., chairman and publisher of the New York Times, and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Judith Miller, who has been reporting on national security for the Times and has now been found in contempt of court for refusing to reveal her sources. On October 7th, Judith Miller was sentenced to up to 18 months in jail. She's free pending appeal. What's your sense of the unanimity or consensus within the world of the working press on this? I see here an editorial from August from the Chicago Tribune arguing that reporters involved in the Plame case should be compelled to reveal confidential sources. And they go with the same line of reasoning. They say, in being told that Valerie Plame was a CIA agent, they were witnesses to a crime. And witnesses to a crime are compelled to speak. A, what about the argument? And B, how have you found, Arthur Sulzberger, the sort of body of your colleagues in the press standing on this issue?
I've received a lot of calls and letters and emails supporting us and supporting Judy because we know how much is at stake. But you're right, not everybody feels that way. For those who don't, I think the biggest difference is the sense that people feel we're asking for absolute privilege. We are not asking for an absolute privilege. 31 states and the District of Columbia give some degree of privilege to reporters. They force the prosecution to ensure that all other avenues have been followed, that all other leads have been tried, before they then ask the reporter to give up that source. As Judy has said earlier, we haven't a clue whether that's been done or not done in this case. We don't know. And I think that's something that we ought to know. We believe we have the law on our side with the First Amendment. That's why we're fighting this case. That's why it's going to go to the appeals court. But clearly we need clarification on this, and we need to have a federal shield law that mirrors those 31 states and that gives reporters the same kind of privilege that a doctor has with a patient, that a psychiatrist has with a patient, that a priest has with a parishioner.
We have those in 31 states, but not at the federal level. Therefore, this exposure remains.
Exactly.
Judy Miller, I just wonder how you answer this kind of charge. So I'm looking here at a letter to the editor from a Robert Anderson in Los Angeles, and he says, she and others, that's you, are protecting two high-level White House sources who intentionally outed a deep-cover CIA agent working on the most important area of our national defense, and so on. I'd like to hear how you respond to that charge.
I'd like to know how the person who wrote that letter knows that. How does he know who exactly transmitted the information about Valerie Plame? Because, in fact, the only information we have that's publicly available is that Mr. Novak, in his column, Bob Novak, said that two senior administration officials did. Now, there might be, hypothetically, a great many reasons why people would come forward and say, I think you need to know more about Mr. Wilson. The person who wrote that letter's assumption that it was individuals connected with the White House who were out to get Mr. Wilson, but I haven't said that, and I won't say that because I'm not going to testify about my sources. Let me just say this about, you know, whether or not there are some individuals who deserve confidentiality and others who don't.
Mm-hmm.
When a reporter gives a pledge of confidentiality, or at least when I do, and as Arthur said, I do that only after I've determined that that person is unwilling to speak to me on the record, that this person might lose his job, or even more than that, if he spoke to me on the record. I don't give these people political correctness tests or virtue tests. I take information from everyone who feels that he or she has a grievance or a story to tell. And then I try and factor in the person's motives and why they're coming to me and whether or not the public needs to know that. I'm speaking hypothetically here, not about this case. This is, you know, just how I go about doing my job. And I think that when one starts saying certain individuals deserve protection and confidentiality and others don't, simply because you don't like their political perspective or you may not like what they have to say, that really means that a whole point of view that might not be heard will not be heard if the reporter makes that kind of decision. So each reporter must draw the line for himself or herself. But I think in my case, I want to hear what anybody has to say. That's called reporting. And then, you know, go on from that point. One thing we've seen, by the way, a lot more of these days is leak investigations. In other words, the government has only so much time to pursue important transgressions, allegations of wrongdoing. More and more, it's spending time on finding out which of its own employees have talked to reporters. I find this trend very pernicious. I find it designed to have a chilling effect on government employees and their ability to come and tell their side of a story. And I think it ought to be something that we're worried about as part of this greater trend towards secrecy in government.
Arthur Sulzberger, let me ask you, just on that front, of course, the subpoena related to the Valerie Plame case is not the only one that you're facing at the time. Judith Miller and Philip Shannon have another subpoena that's headed their way, that's going after telephone records related to their reporting on activities of Islamic charities, also the same special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald. In the LA Times, Tim Rutten writes about what he calls the Bush administration's war against the press entering a chilling new phase. Would you go that far? Do you see a war against the press? Do you see a chilling effect afoot here?
I don't know whether I'm feeling chilled or not on this issue. I know I feel strongly about it, and I think all journalists feel strongly about it, and we're going to make our positions known, and we're going to take our stands, and we're going to continue to do our job. And that's the most important part of this. What's happening to Judy is, I would argue, unconscionable. And the other subpoena you talked about is nerve-wracking, because after all, once they get the phone records, they got the phone records not only for whatever case they happen to want, but for a lot of other stuff. Who else has been talking to New York Times journalists and about what issues? I mean, you're really into some pretty tough territory there. But this is not going to stop the New York Times. It's not going to stop Time Magazine. It's not going to stop the Washington Post. Because we've been through this period before, and we've always come out at the other end, and we're going to come out stronger, which doesn't make it any fun, and we need support, and we need allies who believe that the cause that we're fighting here, the free flow of information in a democracy, is a critical cause. We're going to be able to fill a newspaper full of stories. If Judy goes to jail, the quality of those stories will be badly lessened if we don't have the ability and the freedom to protect our sources, to have people talk to us. Democracy will be damaged by this.
Judy Miller, a last question. As you sit here today, how do you feel about the case? Are you going to beat the rap?
Well, I will not surprise you, agree with my publisher, which is that I do believe that the law ultimately is on our side. I think that 31 states in the District of Columbia have indicated that there is some special protection for journalists doing our job. In fact, in the state of New York and in the District of Columbia, the protection for journalists is absolute. And I'm hoping that the appellate court will find in our favor. Clearly, you know, I'm not looking forward to going to jail. If I have to, I will. But I do feel comforted by the fact that the institution that I work for and that I believe in and that I'm so proud of has stood by me so adamantly and stood by this principle so adamantly. And I'm hearing from journalists, not just across America, but really all over the world. I've gotten calls from Spain and from Russia where people kind of understand what's at stake here. And that is comforting. It's somehow just a little less lonely now.
Judy Miller, we'll be watching and paying attention on Pins and Needles. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Arthur Sulzberger, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., chairman and publisher of the New York Times, and Judith Miller, reporter at the New York Times, now being held in contempt of court and facing, pending appeal, an 18-month jail sentence for that. We're talking tonight about journalists facing jail time in the Valerie Plame CIA outing case, about reporters under the gun to reveal confidential sources. We're 1-800-423-8255. I am joined now from New York by Jeffrey Stone a law professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He's former provost at the University of Chicago. He serves on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union, Illinois Division. He's author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Stone.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks for being with us. You are on the record saying that the courts are right in going after these reporters, in threatening them with jail time to get them to give up their sources in this case. Why?
Well, let me qualify that by first saying I would favor a federal statute that would provide protection in this case. And I
the so-called shield law.
Shield law. And I do believe that the Supreme Court has erred in its interpretation of the First Amendment in this regard. But I think there's a difference between what your guests want and what the law provides. The difficulty here is that there is no federal shield law that gives Judith Miller the rights that she would like to have, and there is no federal First Amendment constitutional protection that would govern this situation. So the fact is that she has no right to refuse to give this information any more than any other individual who is called to a grand jury has a right to refuse to give the information.
And yet you hear the argument here for why confidential sources are important and why they need to stay confidential. Justice Potter Stewart, of course, wrote that the primary purpose of the constitutional guarantee of a free press was to, quoting him here, as Arthur Sulzberger did, to create a fourth institution outside the government as an additional check on the three official branches. And here you hear the Times saying, look, if whistleblowers or anybody who wants to tell us something inside the government can't trust that we will keep their names private, then we're not going to hear from inside the government and American democracy will suffer.
Yes, the problem is that quote from Justice Stewart was from a dissenting opinion. And the Supreme Court emphatically, in a 5-4 decision, rejected the notion that the First Amendment gives reporters these rights. And that's the difficulty that the New York Times faces in the current situation. There is no federal shield law, and there is no First Amendment right that would protect Judith Miller in this situation. Now, it's perfectly legitimate for Judith Miller to challenge the contempt citation and to seek to get the United States Supreme Court to change his mind on this question. But as long as the law exists as it is now, it seems to me unconscionable for a reporter to be promising sources absolute confidentiality when there is no legal basis for such a promise.
But you know that reporters do this every day, and they respect it, and they've gone to prison for it before. I mean, you're a First Amendment scholar. We understand that the court precedent that you're citing, but on its merits, if you look at this through the prism of the Constitution and the needs of a democracy, do you agree with where the law as you interpret it stands now?
No. As I said earlier, I think that there should be both a federal statute and a decision that overturns the Brandsburg decision in the Supreme Court. But the fact is there is a clear state of the law at the present time, and under that clear state of the law, a reporter has no business giving a source a guarantee of confidentiality because the law does not recognize such a guarantee. I could walk around and give people all sorts of guarantees, but if the law doesn't in fact protect me in them, I'm being irresponsible.
So you're saying that right now all that protects those confidential sources is the reporter's commitment to go to jail if necessary, not to give up the name.
Right. And that is also highly problematic because a reporter should not regard the journalism profession as above the law in this regard, any more than those people who run schools in South Carolina in 1955 should regard their views of the law above that of the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education. We live in a society of laws. Journalists have to comply with those laws. If they believe that they need to conduct a wiretap in order to overhear a conversation in which they think a bribe will take place, they have no legal right to do that, and they could be criminally punished for conducting that wiretap. Or they want to break into a senator's office in order to find a document that they think will incriminate the senator. They have no legal right to do that. The First Amendment doesn't give them that right, and no statute gives them that right. They're not above the law in that respect, and they're not above the law at the present time with respect to grand juries.
I want to bring one more voice in here. I have to say, Jeffrey Stone, as a journalist, I don't like the sound of what you're saying. I've promised confidentiality to many people over the years, and I certainly would stand by it. Let me turn to one more guest. Ed Baker joins us from New York. He's a law professor at University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's a leading authority on the First Amendment and mass media policy, author of Media, Markets, and Democracy. Ed Baker, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. You see what's on the table here, a couple of reporters facing potential time in jail and this issue of confidentiality. Jeffrey Stone is saying they shouldn't even be guaranteeing it to sources because there's no basis in the law for them to give that. If they're going to be law-abiding American citizens, they shouldn't give it. And when they're asked, they should cough up those names. What do you say?
Well, Jeffrey and I agree on a lot. We agree that Brandsburg ought to be overturned.
Brandsburg, please spell that out for us.
B-R-A-N-Z.
Metaphorically, what's the case that you're citing there?
Yeah, a case that Jeffrey referred to where the question of confidential sources went to the Supreme Court. And by a 5-4 decision, they appeared to reject the notion that they had a constitutional right to protect the sources. The case is actually a little more complicated than that. Powell wrote a concurring opinion that many lower courts has read to say more what Justice Stewart said. So many federal court of appeals have recognized a reporter's privilege, despite the apparent 5-4 decision the other way. So the law at present is not near as clear, I would say, as what Professor Stone is suggesting.
And what's the wiggle room that you see Justice Powell having left?
Well, he described the importance of protecting sources for the purposes of confidentiality, and he said that prosecutors ought to respect that. And in a way, he described the circumstances where they should be allowed to require identifying sources in language that was very similar to what Justice Stewart was arguing for in dissent. So though he concurred, he signed the opinion of Justice White rejecting the privilege. He wrote an opinion that seemed to recognize a privilege. At least that's what the lower federal courts have interpreted him as doing. And so they've read the court somewhat differently, the decision somewhat differently than Jeffrey Stone.
Jeffrey Stone, do you not see that beam of light opened here by Justice Powell for reporters like Cooper and Miller?
Justice Powell said only that he thought it might be appropriate to recognize a privilege if there were harassment or there were no legitimate basis for the investigation. And I don't think there's any plausible argument that either of those two situations is present here.
But you know those arguments have certainly been made in this case. That we haven't heard about what's going on with Robert Novak. Why are they going after these two journalists in particular? There is a kind of aura of harassment around this case.
Well, grand juries operate in secret. I mean, I have no reason to myself to suspect that there's any harassment in this case. Harassment in the way Justice Powell meant it, that meant, in fact, illegitimate reasons for bothering reporters when there's no rational ground for believing that they might have any information. Now, if Judith Miller has absolutely no information, I can't understand why she simply wouldn't go to a grand jury and say, I have no information.
Ed Baker.
Justice Powell actually said the asserted claim to privilege should be judged on its facts by striking a proper balance between freedom of the press and the obligation of all citizens to give relevant testimony. And that proper balance seemed to suggest that the claim of privilege was one of the things that the court should consider in each case. And that's what the lower courts have done. So they've allowed, they've interpreted that to allow the court to order testimony in some circumstances and not in others.
Ed Baker, Jeffrey Stone, I want to hear from our callers on this, and we will in just a minute. We're talking tonight about journalists facing jail time in the Valerie Plame CIA outing case. What do you think? Who's in the right here? Who's in the wrong? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about journalists facing jail time in the Valerie Plame CIA outing case, reporters under the gun to reveal confidential sources. You can join the conversation. If confidential sources are exposed by force of law, will insiders stop talking to the press? Will citizens be left deeper in the dark about their government? If it comes to it, should Matthew Cooper and Judith Miller go to jail for 18 months to protect their sources, or should they talk? Do you sense an intimidation campaign here, or just good law enforcement? And this, why doesn't the president get his underlings to fess up rather than see journalists go to prison? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Of course, the first news came from Robert Novak, syndicated columnist, a conservative columnist out of Chicago, who said two senior administration officials told me and went on to give this story. Robert Novak has declined to say whether or not he's talked to the grand jury. Sumner is calling from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Hi, Sumner. You're on the air.
How are you?
I'd
like to say that lawyers, doctors, religious figures have no absolute privilege, and why should journalists? In this case, this is a case where there was an attempt to steal an election. There was an attempt to discredit the ambassador's criticism of the Bush's motives for taking us to war. And this is purely political. And unfortunately, Ms. Miller appeal is going to take enough time so that we won't have the answer to that until after the election.
But whose fault is that? I mean,
whose fault is that?
Yes.
Well, I think we have to look at the motives for this particular leak. Okay.
This
leak was in fact a violation of the law. The law is clear that you're not supposed to leak the name of a CIA agent, an active agent.
Well, and there is some ambiguity around it, but that sits there, and you know, Ambassador Wilson.
There's no ambiguity.
Yes, in fact, there is. I'll look it up for you here in a minute. But in fact, there is. But Ambassador Wilson says that this was revenge for him debunking the Bush claims about a yellow cake in Niger. Why shouldn't the Bush administration offer up the wrongdoer here, if there is one?
Well, they obviously should, except that it's not in their political interest to do it. Clearly. Okay, if Bush wanted to do what he said he was going to do and make sure that his underlings cooperated,
yeah,
then that would have been done.
And Sumner, let me just ask you this: if you're still there, Sumner, what about the case that you heard New York Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger make? If we give up confidential sources, people are going to stop talking to us, and we won't know what's going on inside the U.S. government.
Well, that's, first of all, a matter in part of the judgment of the journalist. Clearly, in this particular case, there was a crime, and there was a political motive. I think the journalist should hold the people accountable.
Sumner, we've got it. Your line's fading on us, but we've got it, and thanks very much for calling in. Let's go to another call right here, if we may. We've got Gordon calling from Boston. Hi, Gordon. You're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry. Looks like we lost Gordon. Imran is calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that I kind of feel like there's a little bit of, trying to get sympathy from the public for something that the press hasn't been very good at since 9/11, which is that, you know, they'll always cite government sources when it comes to these stories without really kind of doing the investigative journalism that's really required. And in a case like Judith Miller where, you know, if she has information about the leak to the CIA, it's like the general impression I have is that, well, she's getting information from somebody who's in the government, which is consistent with the habits of most of the press.
Well, she hasn't published this, but what's been said here is that senior administration officials reached out to the press, not the other way around, and said, hey, by the way, do you know Valerie Plame is a CIA operative? Now, and then hiding under confidentiality. Imran, thanks for calling. But then there's this wrinkle, and let me put it to my guest Jeffrey Stone at the University of Chicago Law School and Ed Baker at University of Pennsylvania Law School. Jeff Stone, we've got the vice presidential aide, Lewis Scooter Libby, offering a waiver saying, I release Cooper and Miller from keeping any confidences that about my anonymity. I'll talk under a waiver. What do you think about this path?
Well, if I can first go back and say, I think Sumner, your caller, had
yes.
it right, that the whole notion of a confidential source is designed to deal with a situation where someone provides information to a reporter where that information itself is of legitimate public interest. And the reason you want to create a privilege is to ensure that that information of legitimate public interest can get to the public. Here, there is no information of legitimate public interest.
But Arthur Sulzberger, we've lost him, but he begs to differ.
Disclosing yep. the name of secret CIA yep. operatives, yep. which is not by any stretch of the imagination an appropriate characterization of a confidential source. This is simply a criminal trying to enlist a journalist in the commission of a criminal act.
And we see that. It's plain and it's galling. But you heard Arthur Sulzberger say, look, it's hard to say who's an appropriate whistleblower and who's not. If you crack down on these, you're going to crack down on all.
No. If you don't know the difference between a person who's giving you information that you want because it's of legitimate public value and an individual who is using you to commit a criminal offense, then you are not qualified to be a reporter. That's a very simple line, in fact.
Ed Baker?
I share Jeffrey's desire to know who gave the information in this case. The principle of the media being able to promise confidentiality and the importance of that for a free press, I think, is a general principle that has to apply in this case as well as others. Jeffrey suggests that this was a commission of a crime. In another case that went to the Supreme Court recently, the press did similarly. They published information that they had reason to know was criminally obtained, and under the law, it made publishing that information itself criminal.
and the Supreme Court protected the press in publishing this information, despite the fact that the existing law said that that was not only the result of a commission of a crime, it was itself a commission of a crime. The Supreme Court found freedom of press protected the reporter.
And what about this issue of individuals giving a waiver after they've been promised confidentiality? We're seeing people saying, well, even that's not a good idea, because if they do that, then the next time any whistleblower's case comes, you know, approaches the public realm, the government or corporation can say, you, so-and-so, I want you to give a waiver if you were the confidential speaker. And so there again, the principle of confidentiality is lost.
Well, do you think a source who does not ask for or receive a promise of confidentiality has to be protected by a reporter?
Well, I don't know if what I think is the most important thing here, but I think it's very important to keep the flow of information coming out of a government that might not like to stop it.
Ultimately, the right here is the right of the source. And if the source is not interested in confidentiality, there's no reason why the reporter should be claiming the right to protect it.
Well, of course, but the argument that's made is, and our time is just about out, but if you start accepting those waivers and journalists act on that, then whistleblowers will be forced, in effect, to give that waiver by employers and give up that confidentiality.
I think that's, if the reporter can be asked to speak and say, no, on principle, I won't, I don't see why somebody is asked to waive any right they might have. Can't say, no, if I have a right, I don't waive it.
Hmm.
That's what the reporter says. I think
that may be a way out.
Point on this is well taken.
Ed Baker, where do you think we're headed here? Do you expect to see Judith Miller and Matthew Cooper sitting behind bars?
In the end, no, but I think that the legal guess is very difficult. The law in this area and even some of the facts of this case in terms of what the government has done to try to get the information by other means is not really available to us, and that would be crucial information in any appeal of this contempt order.
Well, we're going to have to follow this case. Meanwhile, the election will slide by without anybody knowing who released the identity of Valerie Plame as a CIA agent, and that is aggravating.
Not necessarily so. If the grand jury wants to proceed without this reporter's information, they can proceed. If they think they have enough information to indict somebody, they can do that irrespective of the appeal in these reporters' cases.
We'll be watching right now. It doesn't seem on that tempo. But Ed Baker at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, thank you very much for being with us. And Jeffrey Stone at the University of Chicago Law School, thanks to you for being with us. In a moment, a coming-of-age story from a promising young Nigerian author. This is On Point. A nationwide strike in Nigeria has helped send world oil prices to record highs, but turmoil and chaos is nothing new to the world's seventh largest oil exporter. In her award-winning debut novel, Purple Hibiscus, 26-year-old Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie writes poignantly about her Nigerian homeland from the perspective of a 15-year-old girl, Kambali. It is a story about family and religion, childhood and adulthood, politics and change. In its review of the novel, The Washington Post called it a breathtaking debut. Tonight, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie talks about the inspiration for her novel, Purple Hibiscus.
I grew up in a small university town in Nigeria and came to the U.S. when I was 19 to go to school. But I think this book came from a sense of homesickness, an intense homesickness, and this need to capture Nigeria. But I wanted to write it through the point of view of a family. I wanted to have a young girl narrating it because I felt that I might fall into sort of too much polemic and too much editorializing about Nigeria's issues. The book is narrated by Kambili, who is 15. She comes from a wealthy family. Her father's done very well for himself. He owns factories, he owns a newspaper. But at the same time, she has a father who's a religious fanatic. And so because of that, her entire life is lived under his shadow. And slowly, though, through the course of the book, we find that she discovers her voice herself in a subtle, quiet way. But in the end, she's become a fuller person than she was at the beginning. And I wasn't interested in sugarcoating Nigeria because I think Nigeria has a lot of problems. But at the same time, I know that there are things I love about Nigeria, things that I think are worthy of loving. So I think it's simply wanting very much for the reader to come away with Nigeria as it is. In this passage I'm going to read, we see the narrator and her family having time together, which is a ritual they do every weekend. But this is particularly significant because we also see this huge political event happen, which is the coup. And through this passage, we see the themes that I think run through the book, the theme of politics, the theme of family love. And we also see religion, which is also a theme in the book. And then we get a sense of what the characters are like as individuals. Papa liked order. It showed even in the schedules themselves, the way his meticulously drawn lines in black ink cut across each day, separating study from siesta, siesta from family time from eating, eating from prayer, prayer from sleep. He revised them often. When we were in school, we had less siesta time and more study time, even on weekends. When we were on vacation, we had a little more family time, a little more time to read newspapers, play chess or Monopoly, and listen to the radio. It was during family time the next day, a Saturday, that the coup happened. Papa had just checkmated Jaja when we heard the martial music on the radio, the solemn strains making us stop to listen. A general with a strong Hausa accent came on and announced that there had been a coup and that we had a new government. We would be told shortly who our new head of state was. Papa pushed the chessboard aside and excused himself to use the phone in his study. Jaja and Mama and I waited for him silently. I knew he was calling his editor, Adekuka, perhaps to tell him something about covering the coup. When he came back, we drank the mango juice, which Sisi served in tall glasses, while he talked about the coup. He looked sad. His rectangular lips seemed to sag. Coups begat coups, he said, telling us about the bloody coups of the 60s, which ended up in civil war just after he left Nigeria to study in England. A coup always began a vicious cycle. Military men would always overthrow one another because they could, because they were all power drunk. Of course, Papa told us, the politicians were corrupt and the Standard had written many stories about the cabinet ministers who stashed money in foreign bank accounts, money meant for paying teachers' salaries and building roads. But what we Nigerians needed was not soldiers ruling us. What we needed was a renewed democracy. Renewed democracy. It sounded important the way he said it, but then most of what Papa said sounded important. He liked to lean back and look upwards when he talked, as though he were searching for something in the air. I would focus on his lips, the movement, and sometimes I forgot myself. Sometimes I wanted to stay like that forever, listening to his voice, to the important things he said. It was the same way I felt when he smiled, his face breaking open like a coconut with the brilliant white meat inside.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, reading from her debut novel, Purple Hibiscus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.